It is 10 past 8. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More at carthagecollege.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We need to postpone our interview with Carthage College's Roger Moriano so we can bring you a memorial tribute today to Shirley Abramson, the first woman to serve as a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the first woman to serve as Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. She was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1976 by then-Governor Patrick Lucy, and elected to 4 10-year terms after that. She served as Chief Justice of the High Court from 1996 until 2015. We were honored to welcome Shirley Abramson into our WGTD studios on two different occasions in 2004 and 2009. And we're going to bring you excerpts from both of those morning show interviews. In the first, I asked her about the already busy day which she had had in the city of Kenosha as part of one of her tireless tours of the state. You've had a good day in Kenosha from the little you've told me thus far. Tell us a little bit about what today has included.
I've had a terrific day. We started out at about 10 o'clock at the courthouse, and there was a reception by the Kenosha County Bar Association, and very many people attended, including lawyers from around the county and some from Racine, county board supervisors, law enforcement, social workers, people from family and health services, and you name them, they were there. This demonstrates that the court system depends on people before us in the routine of things and people after us, and that there are a lot of room for collaboration and cooperation, and we each depend on the other. So it's always good to see everybody.
Hmm. That touches on what my next question was going to be, which is namely to tell us a little bit about what the experience has been. You're roughly halfway through, I think, this tour of all the counties of Wisconsin. Tell us, first of all, why you have undertaken this, if this was, in fact, your idea, and what it was that you hoped that you would gain.
Well, it came up at a meeting, and district court administrator said, well, if the justices would go out, they would see this, that, or the other thing. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And I committed myself to visit all 72 counties. Now, I have been to Kenosha many times over the 30 years that I've been on the Supreme Court. But I come for a variety of purposes, but now I'm focused when I come to Kenosha, namely to go to the courthouse and visit with the people and invite the public to come to the courthouse. And my goal is to find out about new and innovative and creative work that the court system is doing. doing along with its collaborators, and to bring messages from other counties so that if Kenosha is interested in a program, it might adapt and adopt another county's program, and educate myself and the Supreme Court, because when we have the next conference on Tuesday, I'm going to tell them about what I've learned in Kenosha.
Hmm. So this stint that you're on right now, I mean, you've been in Kenosha today. Mm-hmm. Has this been part of a few days that you've been on the road, or is this just kind of a one day?
No, today is a one day. I was in conference yesterday. Tomorrow I'll be in the courthouse writing. Kenosha is far enough from Madison that it takes me a day, you know, a couple of hours, a little more to get here and a couple of hours back. And I spent the whole day. In some counties that are closer together, I can spend a half a day in each of the counties. And comes July, I'll go on the road for a week or 10 days. And then just stay at hotels and motels and visit counties, especially in the northwestern part of the state where it's so far to travel that you ought to stay for a while.
Absolutely. That sounds like a good idea.
And do it in the summer when you can have a good time up there.
Very good. I mentioned before we went on the air that it feels like maybe several years ago now that I had the pleasure of speaking with several justices on the Supreme Court. And that was in Racine.
That's right.
And I don't know if that was part of a similar sort of experience in which they were visiting various places.
We take the court on the road at least once a year. With budget tightening, it's once a year. Sometimes we've done it twice. But the court sits in oral argument at a courthouse. So we've been in Racine,
right.
And we've been in Kenosha, too, Milwaukee, and a whole variety of counties. I think we're... Well, I think it's our 13th year, and probably have visited 16 or 17 counties. And that is another way of learning about the county and having the people learn more about how the Supreme Court operates.
Very good. We're speaking today with Chief Justice Shirley Abramson. I'm afraid I have not done my homework in terms of knowing very much about where you come from, and also don't know very much about your road into the world of law. Can you tell us first where you come from and at what point during your early life this road began for you?
Well, I was born and raised in New York City, which is what you might be hearing in my voice.
Just a trace.
I don't hear it, so I haven't ever changed it. But I've lived in Wisconsin for about 47, 48 years now. We came to Wisconsin first in 1956 when my husband was on a postdoctorate in genetics, and I did a doctorate in law at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We left for 3 years and came back in 1960 and stayed. And then I began practice of law in Madison and came on the court in 1976. And have been Chief Justice since 1996.
Very good. So you moved to Wisconsin the year I was born.
I wish you hadn't said that.
There you go. It makes somebody feel old and someone feel young around this table, probably.
You have more gray hair than I.
I certainly do. More gray hair than most people I know. So what drew you originally to law and to exploring this world in the first place?
Well, the answer is I don't know, but as long as I can remember, I've wanted to be a lawyer, and I trace it back to when I was about 6 years old. But why, I don't know. My family had a small neighborhood grocery store. My parents were immigrants with probably less than a high school education. They didn't have a lawyer. I was never in a law office until I finished law school. But that was my dream.
It's funny, too, because I'm gathering that I'm sure that was before the days where there was very much on television even about lawyers.
There was no television, or at least no one had television. I'm sure that it was in the developmental stage.
Yeah.
I guess in 1939, my folks saw television at the World's Fair. There were books and there was radio, and I have no idea
where you got this idea.
No idea, but I decided, and I just kept it up and
and I'm wondering
went
when,
on.
And when you began studying this thing, which actually you knew nothing about, I mean, was it kind of a rude awakening, or was it sort of what you imagined? I mean, was it as fascinating as you sort of dreamt it would be?
I was fascinated, but the first year of law school is very scary. And
where was that, by the way?
Indiana University.
Ah.
And so I can remember thinking, here all my life, or at least most of it, why I wanted to be a lawyer, and now I was in law school, and it was so frightening and so difficult with a new language and different ideas. And I was really concerned that maybe I had chosen wrong, although it was a little late to start changing. But it turned out very well, and once I got over the concern and the exam grades came back and I was going to stay in school, everything was perfect.
By the way, what did you study as an undergrad? Were you in some kind of pre-law program?
Well, sometimes people call this a pre-law program. I was in political science and English literature.
Ah.
But I think that the counselors will tell you now that any program that makes you think, makes you analyze, makes you write well, is good, and that it's pre-law. And if you're interested in engineering, you ought to go to engineering school. If you're interested in business, do that. Some of my best law clerks and intern student workers have been in engineering. One of my best students was from dance. And was just a wonderful lawyer. So that was what she was interested in. So do it.
Yeah. What did you end up sort of gravitating towards as a specialty as a lawyer?
Well, when I was in practice, which was from about 1964 to 1976 in Madison, the firms were much smaller and we tended not to specialize.
Ah.
So you got a very broad view of the law. But after a couple of years within the firm, you might try and do some specialization. So I tended towards corporate law, business law, probate, wills, real estate, transactional law kinds of things. Although, you know, I did my fair share of family law and was appointed counsel in a criminal case. So I got a broad perspective.
At what point did you start to like the idea of Judge Shirley Abramson?
Well, it was quite a shocker. I had never thought of being a judge. I was just happy to get a job in the 50s. You know, it was not easy for women in the law at that time. We were such a small group. And so I was just delighted to have a job and really enjoyed practicing. And there was an opening on the Supreme Court, and friends thought I was a good selection for the governor, and all of a sudden my picture was in the newspaper, and I thought, judge, well, that might be interesting. So it was not a career goal, but it became one, and when I got the gubernatorial appointment by Governor Lucy, I took it, and I thought, well, if I liked it, I'd stay, and if I didn't like it, I'd have to go. But I liked it. And it was a great opportunity to do something for the state, and a great opportunity to look at law at its cutting edge and in interesting cases, and at the same time help people but develop the law.
Yeah, nothing could be sweeter than that. So that was 1976.
Six, right.
Now, I think sometimes I teach music at Carthage, as I mentioned, and sometimes we have students who come to us who think they want to become choir directors because they loved singing in choir so much. And I don't think it dawns on them that to stand in front of the choir is completely different from sitting in the choir and singing. And I wonder if this is at all a similar sort of thing, in that it is one thing to be down there on the floor with the client. It's another to be that imposing figure up on the bench.
That's right, and I think that's a very good observation. And sometimes people prefer one or the other, and it's very important you know yourself, and before you hop from one side of the bench to the other, that you carefully think it through. But of course, there's nothing quite like experience. But if you've made a mistake, you ought to get out and go on the other side. Some people really prefer to be an advocate and advocate a position. There's a lot more freedom for the individual. Judges are quite restrained. On the other hand, other people prefer to be able to make decisions on a case after it's all presented. And of course, for many people, over a lifetime, there's the right time to be a lawyer, and a right time to be a judge, and a right time to be something else.
So this felt like good timing to you.
That was good timing. Every 15 to 20 years, if you can, it's good to change. If you have a wonderful opportunity, change jobs, because I think it's refreshing. It gives you an opportunity to recreate and just learn again, and that's good.
Very good. For those of you just joining us, we are speaking today with Chief Justice Shirley Abramson, Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Chief Justice Abramson, I think it would be interesting if you could help us understand kind of the day-to-day nuts and bolts of how the state Supreme Court does its work, and maybe even help us understand the nature of what that work is.
I'm glad you asked, because the judges and the judicial branch are the least understood branch of the three branches of government. And so we have trial courts. And in Kenosha, we have the Kenosha County Circuit Court. And that's where the trial happens. And that's sort of what you see in a lot of TV shows. That's the trial court. There may be a jury. The witnesses appear. The judge makes a decision about the facts and the law. Most cases stop there. A few go on. In about 3,500 cases, someone is unhappy with a decision and wants to appeal. And you have a one right of appeal in this state, and you will then go to the Court of Appeals. And this state has four districts of the Court of Appeals, and if you go to the Court of Appeals, you will have a multi-judge court. That is, you will have three judges. No more trial. The trial has been had, all the evidence is in, and the Court of Appeals will look at the record. That is, they'll look at all the transcribed notes of all of the trial. And their goal is to decide, did you get a fair trial according to the law? It's not a question of a perfect trial, because chances are you don't get a perfect trial, because we're all human. So mistakes may have been made by either lawyer or the judge, but it's a fair trial.
If I just may jump in for one question. How is that related, the question of did you get a fair trial versus was the correct verdict rendered? Mm-hmm. Because it seems like those are actually two different questions.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, if the correct verdict wasn't rendered because there wasn't sufficient evidence, you didn't get a fair trial. Mm. So the court could say you have to do it again because the evidence was not enough for the jury to say you get damages or you're guilty. That's rare, because most of the time the judge would have directed the verdict. Not all the time. It's more apt to be, when I say fair trial, a trial that is done according to the statutes and according to the Wisconsin Constitution and federal constitution. And that's my shorthand, is saying fair trial. And so you look to see whether a proper evidence was admitted or improper evidence was excluded. Did people have an opportunity to speak and bring in their witnesses? Did they make the right rulings under the state statutes? And if you've had a serious error, then there's a reversal, but most cases are affirmed mm-hmm. on appeal.
So I was just wondering, because it seems to me theoretically possible that an incorrect verdict could be rendered, but it could still have been a fair trial in terms that you did everything correctly, but
Well, it depends on what you mean by incorrect. You may think it's incorrect, well, but I mean, the jury thought it was okay.
Sure, if somebody really didn't rob that bank, but the court says they did or something.
Well, if you could prove they really didn't rob the bank, one would hope that there's a system in error.
Right, so the system really should
do that.
Right, so the system should prevent that.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, for example, people now are getting DNA tests. They may have been, you've read in the newspaper, they may have been imprisoned. And the witness swore that he was it. And did it honestly.
Yeah.
But people look alike. And
sure. I mean, I guess that's where those mistakes...
Mistakes can happen.
So it's the difference, I guess, between honest mistakes and a trial where really procedures were not properly followed.
Right.
I mean, and by the same token, I suppose you could follow procedures exactly correctly and or incorrectly, let's say, follow incorrectly, and yet... just happen to arrive at what is ultimately the truthful verdict.
That's right. But in our system, we would say that's not appropriate because you did not get a fair trial. It's not the end result, but what happened during the trial.
Right. So once somebody goes to this stage of the criminal justice system, then what can potentially happen after that?
Well, you're not even at our court yet. So if you're at the Court of Appeals... now you got 3,500 approximate cases there, and you get a decision. Well, you might just stop, and most cases stop there. But about 1,000 ask to come to our court and get a second review. And we look at each of those cases and decide whether or not the case presents a issue of statewide legal significance. And if it does, we'll take your case. And out of the 1,000, we'll take somewhere between 70 and 95 a year. The rest, the Court of Appeals, is the end. Now, somebody asked me at lunch today, what happens? Can you go from our court elsewhere? And yes, you can. If it's a federal question, you can seek review in the U.S. Supreme Court. But they only take about 75 cases, and they get about 7,000 requests. So you can ask, but the chance of getting there is not high.
Right. So who makes that determination about the cases which you, in fact, will take on? I mean, do you yourselves as a court decide
yes.
that?
Yes. There are 7 members of our court. I'm the Chief Justice because I have seniority on being on the court, and the Constitution says... that person's the chief. I've got 6 colleagues, and we sit around a big table in the state capitol, and we look at each case, and we have materials on each case. I call the case, and there's a recommendation by court staff, and I say, do you agree? And if they agree, that's it. If they want to talk about it, we talk about it. They can disagree with the recommendation, and we'll take the case or not take it. And you need 3 votes. And then if you get 3 votes from the 7 justices, you will be on our docket. And then you'll get you'll be heard in oral argument. You can submit written materials, and the court will hear you and question you or your counsel. And then we'll have a written opinion. And you can read all of our opinions on our website, wicourts.gov. You'll find out a lot about us.
How would you characterize right now the 7 justices that comprise the U.S. Supreme Court? I don't mean every single thing about every justice, of course.
The state Supreme Court?
Supreme Court. In terms of... are you a relatively cohesive body, or is there a fairly wide range of legal perspective represented among the 7 of you?
Well, the reason you have 7 is you hope there's going to be a wide range of legal perspective because the cases that come to our court are very difficult. And it's by 7 people who are well-versed in the law, who have different experiences in the law, coming together and discussing the cases and studying cases, that you are most apt to reach a good result for the parties involved and for the people of the state of Wisconsin. So diversity is important.
Is it always the seven of you hearing every case?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Just the seven, and if one of us cannot hear the case because we have a justice who has a son who practices law, and if the son's on the case, that justice doesn't sit, for example, then the six of us will sit. We don't have a power to bring in a seventh.
Mm-hmm. How much of what you do involves actually talking, discussing verbally the cases that come before you? And are those, and assuming that discussions do occur, do they occur one-on-one or more corporately, I mean, as a group? How does that typically occur?
Well, we discuss the case briefly before we hear oral argument, about 15 minutes each case just to get the court's juices flowing. We then go out to oral argument, and it's usually an hour per case, and that is a discussion with the lawyers and also a discussion among the justices, too, because we listen to each other's questions and play off each other's questions. Then at the end of the day, at about 3 o'clock, we go into the conference room, which is behind closed doors, and we then discuss each of the three cases we've heard, and we can start at 3, and we may not be out of there until 7 or 8. Just depends on the nature of the case. And so there's a vigorous discussion then. The case is assigned to somebody in the majority. And then it can be discussed in ones and twos and threes and fours and corporately. That is, all of us together. And it's a discussion, and it's no trading of votes, no trading of cases. You sign the case, you write it. But there's a continuing review by each of us, whether we discuss it or not, of the case. You have to think play devil's advocate with yourself about your tentative decision. And I've seen cases leave the conference room at 7-0 going one way, and by the time it comes back and you see it in writing, everybody says, oh, that doesn't work. It'll go 7-0 the other way.
Wow.
Or divided court. So it's a continuing discussion.
Hmm. I also wonder, in terms of the cases which you hear, and how many did you say there are a year?
Between 70 and 95.
Mm-hmm. I wonder how many of those are, let's say, rather sort of corporate kind of cases, and maybe in terms of the average man or woman on the street, I mean, fairly dry, uninteresting kinds of cases, versus the more sort of personal cases of a individual person with some experiencing some kind of terrible anguish at the hands of someone, and I mean, can you help us understand the nature of the cases?
Well,
you
let
see
me in- let me ask you a question. Suppose I was to tell you that this case involves interpreting an insurance policy. Would you think that's dry and corporate?
Hmm. I suppose at first glance I would say yes,
and yes, right.
And yes, it really impacts individual people.
Sure. Because you may have the next accident that would be involved with that provision. And so my response to you is that maybe at first blush, many of the cases would look dry to you and that they don't affect you. But on second look, you'd say, that could affect me. And so cases, you might not have any children, but there may be a juvenile delinquent case. But it does affect you. It affects the quality of life in your community. It affects democracy. It affects how you live in the United States. And if anybody isn't getting a fair shake, that really affects all of us. And one of the most important things in democracy is to have a neutral, fair, impartial, nonpartisan judiciary. A judge who calls the cases on the basis of the facts and law, not being dictated to or intimidated by the executive branch or the legislative branch or public opinion or special interest groups or money or anything else. Call it fair and square. That affects you. And so what's happening in the courts affects you. because it's a quality of life issue. And I'm glad to say that that's the kind of justice you get in Wisconsin, and we have to keep it that way.
Absolutely. Is it work that keeps you up at night? I mean, do you toss and turn in bed at night? I mean, with certain cases, I mean, because I'm assuming that when cases reach you, often it is because they are difficult cases that other courts have wrestled with.
They are very difficult, and you do wrestle with them, and you worry them. There's just no doubt about it. I tend to work long days, and so by the time I get home, I fall asleep. But I find that I must think in my sleep or something, or maybe just the rest, because when I wake up in the morning, some things might be much clearer to me than they were when I went to bed. So I don't resent sleeping. I think it's a refresher for me, and that something helps.
A closing question. For as much as there is right about the criminal justice system here in Wisconsin, are there things, if you were able, that you would change?
Well, no matter how good a system is, it can be improved, and we are trying very hard to improve it. And one of the things we're doing, and we're working with law enforcement all the way through the Department of Corrections, is that we're looking for ways of enhancing public safety. And you can enhance public safety, perhaps, by using methods in addition to putting people in prison and in jail. So that and ways that might be cheaper and more effective, because what you want to do is reduce recidivism. You don't want them to come out of prison worse than they went in, and you don't want them to do something again. So that we're looking at techniques within prisons and outside for drug rehabilitation and treatment, alcohol, substance abuse treatment. The largest mental health institutions in our states have become the jails. That's a very expensive way of not treating mental health problems. I'm not talking about significant violent crimes. I'm talking about misdemeanors and people acting out because they have mental health problems. We don't want to tolerate them acting out, but the way to get a handle on it is not necessarily by jailing them, which is very expensive, but by trying to get them the appropriate meds and the appropriate treatment. So I think a major advance in the criminal justice system is a criminal justice study committees locally, and Kenosha has one, so that you look at these problems as a system, not as a separate entities, because we're all in this together. And so I think that that's a very important part of it, and I think that the public can look forward to a better system.
So how long will you be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, if I may ask? I mean, do you see yourself doing this for a long time to come?
Well, I'll be on the Chief Justice as long as the people of the state keep reelecting me.
Oh, I guess I'd forgotten that.
That's right.
That's part of what this reality is.
Right.
When do you face election again?
2009. We have 10-year terms. So I started in 76, so I think I'm on my fourth elective cycle.
Very good.
Former Wisconsin Supreme Court Chief Justice Shirley Abramson, who passed away this past Saturday. To finish out the hour, here is an excerpt from the second of the two morning show interviews I was privileged to do with Shirley Abramson. This was during a visit to Kenosha in 2009.
This is actually a big part of what you do, or what you choose to do as Chief Justice. I know that you take great pride in the fact that you have visited every county in the state, and I'm sure many times over by this point in time. Tell us about your travels, and what you think you gain, or what is gained by you spending so much time doing this.
Well, every time I go into a county, and I have been in Kenosha County on these visits, we go to the courthouse and invite everyone to come. And I meet with county board members, with law enforcement, with the judges, with the court staff, with the Department of Corrections, Department of Health and Social Services, private and faith-based treatment programs, everybody who's connected with the court system. Because the court system is not only the judges in the courthouse, but the court system is before you ever get there and way after you leave. So they're all stakeholders, and they all play a part. And collaboration and cooperation are very important. So what I learn is what the Kenosha or another county is doing in terms of handling the business of the people in the judicial system. I learn what creative, innovative programs they've put into effect, and I learn what issues there are and what problems there are. And I listen to not only the people in the system, but community leaders and people who come from the community to talk with me. And I bring innovative programs from one county to the next. And we write them up in our newsletters. And when there's a problem, some of them I can solve almost instantly by a call into Madison. Others take a much longer time.
I was going to ask you, who's asking the questions? Are you asking questions of the folks that you meet in these encounters, or are they peppering you with questions, or are the questions kind of flying in both directions?
The questions and comments fly in both directions. I ask questions, and the people in the community ask questions of me about the state system and also about what they can do in their own home communities.
What is the range of diversity between, for instance, the concerns and issues that are of prime importance in a place like Kenosha County versus, let's go to the opposite end of the state when you get up around Superior and Rhinelander and so on, places that you've also visited? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's all Wisconsin, but of course at a glance, utterly different. Mm-hmm. Are some of the concerns, however, basic enough that you hear a lot of the same concerns, or are we talking about very, very different arrays of concerns and priorities?
Well, the concerns are pretty much the same. What can be done to alleviate these concerns may differ depending upon whether you're in a rural or urban area or a heavily populated area versus an area which is more sparsely populated. So one basic issue that we hear over and over again is that there is alcohol and drug abuse and among people who get into the criminal justice system, and also mental health problems. One finds that alcohol and drug abuse and mental health issues tend to come together in a particular individual. And we're not talking now about major crimes of violence that people have to go to prison and about. Talking about all crimes are important, but these are lesser crimes that affect the quality of life, but that might be treated in a different way than prison, that they people might be taken out of the county jail or taken for a shorter time, put in county jail, and have different ways of dealing with underlying issues. So we have alcohol and drug courts around the state, and they're everywhere from far northwest to the far southeast. And we trade information about how to work these courts. And they are a little different in each community depending upon the needs of that community. So these are basic issues. Another basic issue is the costs of transporting prisoners around the state, or even transporting prisoners within a county, depending upon how close the jail is to the courthouse. This is a safety issue for the deputies, a safety issue for the public, and a cost issue. It's very expensive. So about 10 years ago, we began a video conferencing program of installing video conferencing equipment across the state in the courthouses. And the sheriff saw the value of this and supplied the funds from their budget. They thought they'd recoup it in 2 years by saving transport costs. Well, in many counties, they recouped it in 1 year.
Wow.
It's so important. And it's good also for mental health patients, because when you remove them from their environment, they may get more confused and disturbed. And here you could use video conferencing for talking with them in their own environment. So that's similar issues.
Are you primarily acting, or maybe even entirely acting, in an advisory capacity when you have these conversations? I mean, when it comes to some of these concerns, what is the tangible difference that a body like the Wisconsin Supreme Court or you as Chief Justice can make when it comes to some of these really thorny issues and challenges?
Well, one, we keep up with the major developments across the country. We keep up with funding sources. Mm. So we can provide a lot of information. We can provide information about where a community might be able to get funds, and we spread that word across the state. We can also be the bully pulpit of talking to judges and talking to the communities, and a listening source. So we provide a lot of staff assistance. For example, one issue across the state is that a lot of people in family court and small claims court represent themselves. And it's hard to represent yourself in a system that's designed for lawyers. So we have staff in Madison who are training public librarians to help, to train law students, to train students from other colleges and technical colleges. We foster local bar associations to help. We assessed each lawyer in the state $50 to raise $750,000 to provide lawyers for poor people who have matters in civil matters in court. And I mean, that's an example where the state can help. And the various local communities, the various courthouses also provide assistance. So we work together, and then we transfer all this knowledge and resources across the state. We've got a program going now. We recognize that mortgage foreclosures have significantly increased. So we have watched this, and we have begun a pilot program in Iowa County where the Circuit Court Judge, William Dyke, is trying to foster mediation. So he's requiring when you the lender, foreclose, that you have to notify the borrower that mediation is an alternative that is available if both sides want to do that.
Hmm.
So this is a creative, innovative program to give the borrower and lender an opportunity to talk with each other to see if they can work something out short of foreclosure. Now, the lender has rights and the borrower has rights, and when they get to court, the court will enforce those rights and those responsibilities. But here's an opportunity which sometimes one or both sides wants.
When was this pilot program begun?
It's begun in January. We've been
So just a matter of weeks.
Yes, and we've been looking at what kind of program we might want to do in Wisconsin and what might be needed. And so we're piloting this. Mm. If it works, we're going to have other counties look at it. If it doesn't work, then we'll have to find out why not and see if there's another kind of program that might assist these parties. Another program, for example, is I noticed in one of my trips across the state that there were a lot of veterans of the Afghan and the Iraqi war in the criminal justice system. And many of these veterans seem to have alcohol and drug abuse and mental health issues. And so we've alerted the judges, we've alerted the prosecutors, we've worked with the defense counsel and with law enforcement so that they try and identify who is a veteran of one of the wars, and that might even be Vietnamese veterans, and see if there's veteran services in the federal system available to them. Medical services, health services. And that increases the alternatives available to the court. So these are the kinds of issues we look for in the administration of justice so that we have equal justice for all people.
Was the Supreme Court of Wisconsin acting in this kind of way? That is, it strikes me as a very proactive way versus just sort of figuratively and literally sitting back on your benches and sort of waiting for things to come to you. This attitude of kind of being out there and really trying to make a difference in terms of the whole system of justice in the state. Has this typically been the way the Wisconsin Supreme Court has acted and seen as its role, or is this something that has come about during your time on the bench?
It hasn't been typical of the court, and you have to remember, we wait for the cases to come to us. We don't go out and decide the cases when they don't come to us. This is at the administrative level of the court system to make sure that the court system is administered for the people of the state. And in that sense, it is relatively new in Wisconsin, but relatively new across the country. And in part, it's because if the courts become overwhelmed with an issue like mortgage foreclosures, like credit issues, which may come down the pike, or veterans, or any other issue, or self-represented people who are a great challenge to the system, then when we're overwhelmed, it's too late to do something. That one should try and foresee what problems and issues and challenges there are. And on an administrative level, try and administer the court system in a way to meet these challenges. And part of the court's ability to do that is because we have computer systems now that can tell us that the foreclosures are up, that can tell us that there are so many self-represented people. And when we see that, then we can say, okay, what should the court system do? For example, there are a lot of people in Wisconsin who do not understand or speak English well enough to know what's happening to them in court. So what do we do? We have a program to certify interpreters. So we are sure that the interpreters understand the language, the foreign language, understand English, and understand basic concepts of law, right? So we certify interpreters. So that does a better system. Once you realize that there are that many people involved, then you have to do something.
So it's a matter of the Supreme Court besides, I mean, I think many of us easily imagine what sort of seems like an important responsibility, but an essentially passive one, where you await for certain especially significant cases to rise up to the point where you have to render a decision on them. But what you are describing now is a very active concern about the other levels of the judiciary, the circuit courts and the court of appeals, the municipal courts, that the well-being of all of that is the responsibility of the Supreme Court, not just to take care of the cases that come to you.
That's right, because the Supreme Court is the administrative head of the entire system, And I, as Chief Justice, am the CEO, Chief Executive Officer, of the entire judicial system in the state of Wisconsin. So we are running a system, and that system has challenges just like every system does, and it's one which we should try and foresee them and try and do something about them. And we do it not for the judges, not for the lawyers, but for the people who have to use that system.
Shirley Abramson, former Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, an excerpt from a conversation recorded in our WGTD studios back in 2009. And the interview with Roger